It's recording. You want to hit? Is it going to two? It's counting up?
I know, it's blinking.
Give it in your big boy voice.
Yeah. Now you can do the announcement.
I'm freezing. Collective bargaining, January 15th, 1915.
Thank you.
1915.
Unless one thing to do.
1-15-15.
Sorry, John.
Good. This is the minutes. We have something.
No, just note for you.
They look okay to me. But
excellent. We have to give one of Barbara.
She's the key person right there.
I didn't change that. This next time it's not at Millikan Hall 395. It's
okay.
College CSB 221.
I think that's 22, maybe. No, it's 20. Okay.
Isn't it 221? I wrote it on that copy there. Yes.
Oh, I'm not. No, I'm not paying attention. It was just. Never mind.
Okay.
Yes, 221.
Yep. All right. Are there any substantive changes then? Please let me know.
Okay.
I was just looking at my I think so.
Okay. Thank you.
Look at me. So have we approved them?
Are the minutes approved?
Do you have any objections, I guess?
No, they look good.
Okay, minutes are approved.
Okay, we have a couple things to talk about today. John and Barbara, and okay. I see you have things too.
Yes, we have things too.
I wonder what we should do. Who should go first?
Do you want to flip a coin?
They should go first.
Heads.
I think they should go first.
Okay, you can go first. We've been going first all last semester.
Okay. We'll be glad to go first. The first thing that we want to do is to have a conversation about some changes that have occurred since the last time we met. In the law, and how they might be impacting the program here at the university. Sherry, do you want to
implement? As you know, I think everybody in this room is probably very pleased with the changes that the state has made. I mean, after being instructed to by the federal courts that marriage is now legal in Florida for same-sex partners. And as you know, we have a domestic partner health care stipend for same-sex partners in Article 2410. And one of the line in there, on the top of page 113, says, it says the stipend amount may also be adjusted at the sole discretion of the university based on availability of program funding. However, employees already enrolled in the program will be given 1 year's notice if the program is to be discontinued. Since the rationale for the program and for it only being extended to same-sex domestic partners at the time that this was enacted was because they did not have the legal ability to marry, as did heterosexual couples. Now that that has been taken care of, we will be discontinuing the domestic partner stipend, since you can now get married and put your spouse on the state health care program. We will follow the collective bargaining agreements, and anybody who is currently enrolled will be allowed to continue until a year from, and I assume HR will send out a notification saying that, you know, the program is being discontinued and we will not be accepting new enrollees in the program. I don't know how many current employees we have in the program. I don't think it's a huge number, but they'll be, you know, allowed to continue until that year is up, and then it will be discontinued, and everybody that wants to be on our health care coverage will have to get married, which may or may not be good news. Since they now have the ability to.
Opt out.
You know, actually, we are in some risk even by doing this, by upholding what we agreed to in the collective bargaining agreement, because this is an equal protection issue, that if some heterosexual couple and who are in a domestic partner relationship wanted to challenge us on, they could, since we do not extend this to heterosexual domestic partners. So, but, you know, we are living up to what we put in the contract, and we will do that, and hopefully we will not be challenged.
State group insurance. The day after Judge Hinkle said, and I mean it, because first he said, this is it, and then they said, well, we're going to wait 30 days to see if someone appeals it, and he said, no, I mean it, like today. That next day, State group insurance issued a memorandum saying they're recognizing, for the purposes of state benefits, including insurance, these marriages. So they've already enrolled people. State group insurance is already in the process of enrolling people. So, and that way, I mean, you have different options under state group insurance in terms of family coverage, and that were kind of dicey under the stipend programs. Hopefully, it works out better for some people. Anyway, we wanted to have that conversation with you about the changing aspect of that particular program and how the law is impacting it. Changes in the law is impacting it.
Well, and conveniently, we haven't gotten to that article yet, so.
Yes.
You don't have to undo something we've already agreed upon.
That's true. That's true. And you know, just being around the state, I know that some of the other participants in state group insurance that have domestic partner benefits are doing the same thing. Yeah. Largely, I think, because one motivation is, well, there's now a program that they can avail themselves of that they couldn't before, those people in that status. But I think also, like Sherry said, the way these programs passed equal protection challenges was because of their different legal status. And that's gone now, so. Yeah. All's good. A new and better day.
Let me ask a question.
Sure.
You had some things that you have brought to the table. Before we proceed with what we were going to put on the table, the two things that we were going to put on the table are probably going to require extensive conversation. So if what you have is something that can be, you know, will be more quickly processed, we might want to extend you the courtesy of starting with those. Is that okay? I didn't mean to.
No, that's good. That's a good point, Sherry.
Still your thunder there.
Okay.
Whatever you think, John.
Yeah, no, that seems like a good plan, just to keep our momentum going from last semester as we take through half the book in one semester, which is, seems like it's pretty good progress. Right. I know you and Jim know the history pretty well. All right, so now that the ULP has been withdrawn, We're ready to TA status quo on Article 9 if you're amenable to that.
Yeah, that's, yeah. We didn't have a problem with
9. I don't recall.
Okay.
Surprise! Let me see. I don't believe. I think we act. Did we not bring that already? 9?
I think we may have, actually.
Okay, so.
Okay, fine.
Okay. And I've got a copy, actually, I think. It might be getting kind of wrinkly.
If not, I can bring one, so.
Yes, I have two copies, actually.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I didn't put the headers on, Charlie. Sorry. He's on the left side?
Yeah.
On every page?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I knew that was too fast.
I was thinking, boy, that's fast.
Yeah.
The initials on
the initials the subsequent page.
And then I sign the last page.
Do you date this?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's to prevent that's the old
the switcheroo.
the old, you know, you're never supposed to sign something that's blank, right? Contract, like, happens sometimes, or letters.
Unless it says this page intentionally left blank.
You know, like, but like, where sincerely falls onto the next.
Yeah.
Supposed to be doing that.
Okay. I know people, but then again,
that's what happens when you're on a break. Lose your whole room.
Article 9.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay. And while we're in that vein, we also have a very short proposal for Article 20, which has only one tiny little change, a deletion. In fact, yeah, this one was so small that I just printed the front page to save some trees and decrease pollution and stuff.
Is this a counter to?
No, Yandi would love you.
No, this is
a new one,
yeah. Start whichever way you want to start. So our intent here is to try to eliminate the ambiguity that led to the proceedings the last time.
We'll take a look at this and have a caucus about it, John.
Okay.
Good. Does anybody have any questions about the proposal?
No.
Okay. So we have a couple of other ones that might be quick, hopefully. One is on Article 6, non-discrimination. And so this one, it looks like a lot of red, but most of it is just putting things in alphabetical order. Everything else, with one exception, everything else on there is listed under the UCF's EE website, and the one exception is the parental status. Mm-hmm. So that is not yet listed on the EEO website. But the rest are all there. So we're trying to bring that up to date.
But it is in a student handbook.
Yes, it is in the student handbook. It's in a variety of other places as well. So just for interest's sake, here are some examples drawn from different institutions of existing anti-discrimination language that centers around parental status, but also sometimes includes other things that UCF added recently, like genetic information. So UCF actually includes both of those in the graduate catalogs policies, so it applies to the graduate students. Several states have it explicitly mentioned. The federal government now has status as a parent. It's had it for quite a while due to an executive order. Orange County Public Schools has a genetic information one. Walt Disney, one of our big local employers, has one that deals with explicitly with pregnancy. So we talked about this the last time that we had a full book bargaining session. We felt like it was close to being agreed upon, and then it wasn't, which to me is a little bit... In my mind, I think of these as null hypotheses, like they're a world without pattern. You just don't think about these things, so they don't require any special effort other than to just not think about it.
So genetic information is also new, because it's not in our current book.
It's not, right, not in the current book, but it is on the website, the EO website. So just so folks know, that's things like, it's coming really soon. When you get, pretty soon you go to the doctor's office, they're just going to genotype you.
Oh, yeah.
And so they'll be able to say, here are all your genes, and you have an allele that predisposes you to risk for whatever disease. So it'll be a means to help make diagnoses and decisions.
Genetic information, I think, is in a federal law now.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that part of the ACA?
ADA?
No, it's called like the Genetic Information Secrecy Act or something.
Yeah.
And there's just it's a district court case, so it doesn't have wide applicability. But it had a strange application lately that is gonna got some people shook up, because it said that if you have a medical questionnaire and you ask about like the health of a person's parents, it violated that law, because you weren't actually getting a genetic code, but you were getting information. So like if you there's some health forms in some workplaces that'll say, are your parents alive? When did they, when were they deceased? And so they think, well, if you use that against somebody, you violate this federal law.
My question about this is, I see that this would prohibit the university from discriminating, I'm assuming, in employment against any employee for genetic information. How would that intersect with the state insurance program. I mean, I don't know if they have anything that they flag and say if you've got this genetic marker at this point that they're not going to cover you for that or not. But, I mean, we have to go with what they tell us on things like that. So
this Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act says both health insurance and employment are protected.
Okay. For the state.
That was the reason for the federal government getting involved in it, was that concern, especially in the...
Well, that's why I asked, was it in the ACA, because I thought that might be part of that legislation.
I think it was... did they have the name of the act in there? It's some weird... It's got some...
Gina?
Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2008.
Yeah, I was familiar with that. I just wasn't aware. I didn't realize that it also applied to private insurance companies.
It was a big, part of the last president's whole deal about, like, genetic testing and all that. It was part of, like, George W. Bush's initiative. Like, he wanted, what they call it,
stem cell
research. All that has to do with, he had this whole agenda where he wanted to prevent everyone going down that pathway of, like, doing genetic testing and cell testing and all that.
Okay.
So that's part of that. That's where that came from. Well, whatever.
I have a clean copy if you want to, if you're inclined to TA it.
Well, you know,
we're going to have some discussion about it.
Okay. Yeah, we have to have some discussion about it because I actually, well, let me say this much. I appreciate this piece of information because, one of the things that we had some trouble getting to a common understanding, I think, was the scope of the protection that would be afforded to parental status.
Yeah, so I'd like to look at some of these policies and see exactly how they spell it out.
Yeah, what exactly would be a viable complaint under that status. So, but I'm going to look these up.
Definitely look them.
Good.
Glasses on, like, wrong notes. I know it's bad.
Now that I know how old you are, I can say that you were younger than me, but now I know.
Okay, and then. All right, the other one that. We have for you today is Article 26, which is the payroll deduction article. And again, this looks like a lot of red ink, but actually, everything that's in the quotation marks under 26.2A1, that's all the language from that Appendix B, just folded into the article. And then the new Section 2 there just says what are the other things that are on the form. And then Part 3 is just the title and the formatting and a new logo if we get our chapter to put one together, that's we can insert that sort of thing. So it's basically that the information is what's important and the exact form isn't as vital. So that hopefully we can process things more smoothly and not run into road bumps and having forms going back and forth in emails. It's meant to simplify things.
Okay.
And I have a clean copy of that one, too.
Do you want to, why don't we give them something so that they can consider something that we want to talk about while, so why don't we do this?
Okay, that's a lot to talk about, but sure.
Oh, this is 12, okay. I was going to ask about 12.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else want 26?
Wow. This is not easy on the eyes.
No.
I tried my best, but you can't make the comments bigger.
Oh, because of printing, yeah. They don't fit on the page.
Or maybe I didn't click on them. I should have tried to click on them directly, so sorry about that.
All right. Do I take it from the top, Sherry?
Actually, okay, Sherry, go ahead.
That's why she didn't want us to hand it out.
There's a lot here. Okay.
So that is continuous.
Yeah.
I mean, I will talk
about it. Yeah, I would like you to talk about it. This is the article that Charlie deals with on a daily basis. And so some of these changes,
makes it sound like we're non-reappointing people all over the place.
No, but people call us about questions regarding this all the time. So, and
Michael seems like he wants to say something.
Ms. Michael?
No, I was just going to say, you know, 12-2 just seems to be clarifying the obvious, because in 1 through 4 it says continuous, so it should just all agree that it's continuous university service.
Well, the problem I had with continuous is that I've had people be in different classes in USPS or A&P positions, and then they become faculty. And so if you've been faculty one day, then, or, you know, you move, and the continuous service, a lot of people go from USPS to A&P, let me say that. And so for that group, which there's only about 40 in-unit A&P people, but for that group, if you've had a USPS position for 6 years and you've been at A&P for 3 weeks, you would get the notice, that's the long notice, because it's continuous service if you haven't had a break in employment. So it's worth just discussing if you want that for your faculty, if you want that for whatever. I'm not saying one way or the other. I just want it clear that everyone understands when you say continuous, even if you cross class or change jobs entirely, that may not be what everybody wants. So I want attention paid to that word.
Okay.
No, so that's actually not even a change. You're just highlighting that word.
I'm highlighting that word because I want everyone to understand that when you change positions, it is not affecting your time the way I think it should, really. If you're A&P and you've been in an A&P position for less than 6 months, well, I don't know if that should change it over to be 2 weeks or not. So people need to think about.
So what you're doing, Charlie, is you're asking a question.
I'm asking a question.
When we say continuous university service,
I'm not saying one way or the other. You could make an argument that you've been a university employee, you've been devoted, and so therefore you deserve that time, or you can make an argument that you're new to it and maybe it's more, you don't have that probationary period that other people might. So, but someone needs to think about it, and so I want people to think about it. That's all. The next thing that's go ahead.
All right. Go ahead.
Okay. The next thing is that culturally, I think at the university, we're accustomed to tenured people being looked at very carefully after their third year of service. After that point, you've had 2 cumulative progress evaluations. And so I think as a culture, we've been looking at people with 3 years as sort of meeting a threshold. Well, when you have multi-year employees, a lot of them receive a 3-year employment agreement right off the bat. So if you don't want them for longer than that 3 years, you have to know way back. And I understand that what negotiations at the table were to strengthen the multi-year agreement. So it really is what it means. It is, if you have a 5-year multi-year, you have a 5-year agreement with the university. I'm just thinking that the 3 years, occasionally, they haven't really looked at the employee because culturally we haven't done that. So since I have a lot of these 3-year multi-years, and then suddenly people are saying, well, wait, we didn't look at them really until they're already in their second year, well into their second year, that it would be nice, I think, in a sense, to shift that in some way, or to maybe just consider it, talk about it at least. Mike, did you have anything before I go to the next thing?
No, go ahead. But except, again, years is not new. It's highlighted, but it's already in the contract, right?
Of course. The only thing that there would be something that would be stricken, and it would be highlighted, which is down below.
Or underlined. Okay, good.
Again, renewed, I don't know. I just hit that word because, okay. So what happens a lot of times with multi-year agreements is that their agreement will start at a weird time. So they'll have some sort of, say, OPS agreement from August 8th until September 1st. And then that multi-year agreement is signed and created and everyone goes. So if you give that person notice, it doesn't end cleanly at a semester. It goes all the way. So you're going to give that person, if that person does get notice, it ends at a peculiar time. And so I just wanted to make people aware of that. It's the discussion point only. So sometimes it seems peculiar if you had somebody, then they would be here for the fall semester, say, for a month because of administrative paperwork that they didn't get a multi-year that started right on 8/8. The next thing, let's see, hold on. Oh, okay. Just for us to talk about, too, when you have CNG people, right now, when you give them notice, you're giving them notice that they will not be reappointed, which right now, and I'm not saying it's good or bad, their employment will end only when their appointment ends. So if their employment, a lot of them are 12-month, they'll go from August 8th to August 7th. So if you want to give them notice, there's not 6 months or 3 weeks or anything having to do with their service necessarily, but it ends only when that agreement ends. So you can terminate it sooner if you're running out of funds. All right. If you have more than one person on a grant, then how am I supposed to say, well, that money is for you and you, but not for you? Because there technically is money in the grant, so you would have to draw down the grant. And help me, does that make sense to you? You'd have to draw down the grant for all three people rather than giving one person notice and keeping the other two in the grant that have things to contribute for the remainder of that contract. Am I speaking language that makes sense to you, John?
I understand what you're saying, yeah. Just in our world, usually different people have different tasks, and
agreed.
So that's where
I agree.
It's more that the task is ending. So.
Well, I have a real world thing where there's money ending in November. I have somebody whose employment's going to end shortly before 8/7, so I think they're just going to go ahead and carry him that extra week or 2 weeks, something like that. But technically, there is money that goes all the way to November, but they're going to end the employment at the contract date,
right.
Luckily, because his task is done. But if the task goes beyond that appointment date, I'm not sure how. I don't want any confusion,
right.
Where I get pushback when it makes sense for this person to be terminated at the end of their contribution to the grant, if that makes sense.
Well, and a lot of this arises because the grant cycles aren't on academic cycles.
Correct. Right. October
to
whatever.
The budget year cycle of whatever the funding agency is, which varies.
So I don't want to have disagreements, and I don't want to have arguments, and that's something you guys can talk about, and that's fine. That's just something that had come up.
Well, did you have a suggestion for?
I didn't want to go to that point. Just we all should just talk about it first, and then maybe we can craft language upon what we agree on. Maybe you like it exactly the way it is, and so then we have to think about that.
I think what Charlie's concern is let's say there's a grant for $300,000 that funds three people at $100,000, and the grant is reduced by $50,000. How does that?
Now what?
How does that work in application? Does the least senior person go? Is everybody's effort reduced?
The language is written as if everyone needs to go to the end of their agreement if they're being reappointed. And I want to make it clear, if there's more than one person on the grant, that you should be able to release somebody, especially if their contributions are ended. So
how often do you see that issue arising? Is it
I don't know. I got this call this last 2 weeks, so it was something that was fresh on my mind. I've had it happen with other things, but not so much because everyone seems to kind of understand the ebb and flow.
I see it. I've seen it at other universities.
Okay. Now I'm at 2 under C.
Mm-hmm.
So personally, I would like to eliminate that phrase. Currently, we have 14 people that do fall under this. They're CNG people, except for one person who I think is misclassified. Every single one of them is an FSEC. So they've been here since the beginning of time. And it seems a little bit inequitable to me that they would get a year's notice when other people don't have that same liberty. And so I wanted to discuss that and why these people had such generous notice. That's simply that point for discussion. D, I don't know if this is the right place for it, but if Sherry, if you wanted to talk about prevailing wage, did you want to take that now?
We're having an issue with prevailing wage, and it's something we have never seen before, but we've had like 3 come up in the last several months. And
I'm sorry, Sherry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but where did you move ahead to?
D, at the top. I'm not sure if this is the right place for it. This talks about people that are on visiting or auxiliary appointments. They just simply don't get any more employment. They're cut off quickly.
Okay.
And it seems as if people that fall into this category who are their immigration status is affected by prevailing wage might belong in this category. It may not. It may have its own section, but this is what Sherry's talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the motivation of the Department of Labor is on this, but, prevailing wage, we had this issue come up once before when I was here, and that was a librarian, and we were at impasse, and she was going to have to go back to China, and it was like a $3,000 increase. It was not a lot of money, and you know, we were like, for the heaven's sake,
it was less than that, I think.
Let's give this woman the money, less than that, and let her stay here. Well, they have been issuing these very high, sometimes facetiously referred to as Boston or New York rates of prevailing wage for people, like they're $10,000 more than the current wage that we're paying them. And in some cases we have lecturers who would now, if we paid the prevailing wage, which we are required by law to do, be making more than associate professors in that same college or that same department. And you can imagine the inequities and the issues that raises with the other lecturers and assistant and associate professors, and they would be the highest paid people in that department, except perhaps a full professor. And the problem that we run into is that there's nothing under federal law that says we have to keep these people if we don't want to meet the prevailing wage. We can certainly send them. We can just say, no, we're not going to meet that because, A, we think that's outrageous for that, and it's causing all kinds of inequities in our department. And, this person just isn't worth that much money to us. Because of our notice provisions, we have bound ourselves to a position that the federal law doesn't require of us. And so, if you know much at all about immigration, which I don't, I'm just now learning more than I ever wanted to, visas, when you come into this country on an H-1B visa, it goes for a 6-year period that you're allowed to stay in the country before you have to either get a green card or go home. However, we hire people in like 3-year chunks. We don't hire them for like 6 years because we hope that they'll get their card. So at the end of that 3 years, we have to do, they have a reevaluation of their status. And if the prevailing wage comes back just enormously higher than we expected it to, we could, under federal law, just say, well, you know, we're not going to throw every, and we're not, you're not worth it to us, and we're not going to pay you that much more than everybody else in your department, so we're not going to extend the visa. However, because of our notice provisions, which overrides the lack of federal regulation in this particular area, we are now having to extend their visas and for a year, or in some cases, if we haven't given the notice quickly enough, 2 years, which, well, or a year and a half.
It feels like it.
Yeah, which is just, because we can't count summer as a...
It's not a semester.
As a semester. So they're getting extremely long notice for having to pay them a lot. In the meantime, other people in their department are complaining. If they have applied for a green card, and it's been in process for at least a year, then we have to extend their, we can extend their visas indefinitely. And so this is, our notice provisions for these people are putting us in a real bind. They're requiring us to do more than federal law requires us to do. And it's creating a problem. And so we would like to put these people in the same category as some of these others and say that if you, you know, that this is an exception to the notice provision that we're otherwise required to provide. And it may be that that should go in a different section, but wherever it goes, that's what we...
That's the interest.
That's the interest.
Do you have any questions, or should I just move on? The next thing is just a note. There is some sort of budget entity called Local, but I looked and there were no Indian employees in it, so I just left it alone, but I thought you should just know that. E, it seems to me like we should start the article with the people that are most affected. I don't care, but it just seems starting out with employees not described in A, B, C, and D above, it might be nice if we just started out with these employees and then have the exceptions that follow. That seems more logical to me, but it's fine. So years ago, we negotiated to have a notice cycle so that we would give notice by May 7th. Did you want to talk about that, or?
No, you can handle that.
I do my best. In March, I call around and look for anyone who needs to take advantage of the non-reappointment service that I offer.
She's a non-reappointment.
So what that means is I look into anyone that might be out there, what the reasons are, and go from there. What this May 7th thing ends up doing, though, is I end up with people contacting me in the fall, and this overlapped with the prevailing wage problem this time, but people contacting me in the fall, and then they've got to get so, so much notice. It's the beginning of the fall, so they're going to work fall. They're going to work spring, they're going to work fall, and they're going to work spring. And it's just too long a period. And the deans are not interested in having that long a time anymore. And I understand what the reasons were at the time, but I do want to open that discussion up again. I provided in that teeny tiny four-point font on the right what the language was before. For employees with two or more years of continuous university service, two full semesters, or 1 year for employees with an assignment greater than academic year. So that language was much more flexible and workable for the university itself, and it's more equitable to people that are non-reappointed closer together, because we're looking at someone who's non-reappointed on 5-5 is going to get a very different period than someone non-reappointed on May 9th. So, any questions? All right. For F, everyone who received notice of non-reappointment is able to get the reasons for doing so. I would like to make it clear, though, that people whose multi-year appointments are expiring, it's simply the end of that agreement, and it's not for reasons necessarily, it's just the end of that agreement. So it seems logical that we should be able to just simply end their contract without providing reasons. It's a multi-year agreement. So, any questions or? Okay. I've never had this be a problem, but I can see it being one. So, you have someone who's CNG, and they run out of money in the grant. Well, I don't want them trying to tell me that I need to find a reasonable effort to relocate them and have recall rights. That doesn't really make sense to me. So I just wanted to have a discussion about making sure that it's clear that non-reappointment considerations, this is intended to be used in a layoff type of situation, not for routine CNG non-reappointments. because if you're in a position for more than 5 years, you are entitled to notice 90 days if there's money left in the grant. So I don't want these to end up in conflict. Again, this has never happened before, but I can see someone making an argument, and I don't want to have that argument. I don't think I've had too much problems with resignations. There were two comments that I wanted to make. Let me do the last one first. If you do not comply with the notice period and leave without notice and leave everybody in a lurch, the university has been able to put a do not hire designation, but I thought it might be nice if we put it in there so that everyone understood that it was there. The other thing is that if you're A&P, if you tell people that you need to give one full semester's notice, under this language, a semester wouldn't count for summer. So I was thinking that if you were A&P and you wanted to give two weeks notice or a certain amount of notice, you better do it in the fall or in early spring, because if you get stuck here over the summer, I wouldn't want someone to be in that situation. I don't think anyone would pursue it, but I just wanted to make sure that that was something that was considered for those people that are 12-month, non-teaching type faculty.
Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
A whole lot going through my head right now, but
sure.
Thanks for the explanations, because that helped me understand what the
concerns.
What the concerns were and what the intent is. We'll have to talk about these.
Okay.
Yeah, we didn't expect it.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, why don't
I don't have anything for you to sign, John.
Well, why don't we take a caucus?
Yeah. Okay, sure. All right, Jim. Push the button once and got it. 37, 38.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity to look at this in caucus. What I think we're going to do is we're going to look at some of the examples of the discrimination language that you have provided us with, and we should have a response to Article 6 next time we meet, which I think is February 5th, I think.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Right. And we'll have a response to Article 20 and Article 26 on the 5th. And we do not have any questions, unless you have one, Sharon, because I think you might have a question.
No, I don't think I do on any of these. I'm fine.
Okay, that's good. Just to check off through my list here too. So we already have UFF already provided proposals on Articles 2, 5, 8, 22, and 29. So we're starting to have these old ones.
Yeah, I thought that we had sent some questions about 22 that had arisen in the context of some sabbatical things, and said you were going to take a crack at that language.
Right, so
actually, I thought you might be doing that
today. We'll count on a 2 next time.
Okay.
We'll count on Article 2 next time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What were the other ones, John?
29, which is the entire agreement.
Entire agreement we're going to come back on next time.
No, 29, severability.
So we will come in with 2, 29, 6,
20 and
26. 20 and 26 next time we meet.
Okay. 2, 29, 6, 8.
No.
No? I'm sorry, I must have misheard. 2, 29, 6, 20,
and
26. So those five. Okay.
And yeah.
Okay.
It's 2, 6.
26 and 26, 20 and 29.
26 and 29.
Okay. Yep, we got them.
All right, so then we'll bring 22 then. Minutes to spill over, or
sure,
tight schedule.
We can talk about, if you want to talk about 12. We had thought we might discuss 13 at some point, but that's going to take some real time. So we're going to have to do that when we don't have a ton of other articles on the table.
Okay. So then, because Barbara and Jim have experience with Article 12 from previously, I'll let Barbara address those. Okay.
So in terms of recalling what we bargained last time. I think the ordering issue was the VOT's idea to reorder it that way because I think people were reading it as if everyone qualified under and they didn't read the exceptions.
Oh,
and so
I
we
see.
Switched it Could so be. That they would notice the exceptions if they...
Makes sense.
Yeah. We don't really have a problem with adding the sentence at the end under resignation about... that you may result in a new do not hire designation. But we think that pretty much all the other concerns that were raised relate to trying to reduce notice that we give to people. And last time that we bargained this, we talked about the main issue for having the notice provisions the way we have them is because of the academic hiring cycle. So academics get hired starting in August, and usually the hiring is done by November, December. So if you give someone notice on December 25th that they're not going to be rehired, they're not going to have a chance to get into the next hiring cycle to be hired the following August. They're going to have to wait out a whole another year. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we set the notice that way, the May 7th notice. So basically, we don't think it's really in our bargaining unit's interest to alter that.
Okay. And that also includes people that are we're talking about with the prevailing wage issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so that the issue with giving notice on a three-year contract or the... just review people every year. They get reviewed, their performance review, and give notice prior to the end of their contract. So that you
but it's not the end of the contract. It's when the DOL issues a new prevailing wage.
She just makes two up. She was talking about multi-year, and she did. Yeah. She moved on. You're talking about prevailing wage.
I'm talking about prevailing wage. That's the one that I think we're going to have the most problem with, because that is an equity issue for other faculty as well. I mean, they're being paid considerably less, and we're not going to just give $10,000 across the board raises to everybody in a department. You couldn't even do that because you've got people that are lecturers on these prevailing wage determinations who are making more than associate professors, so you would have to graduate the increases even more than you couldn't just raise the associate professors so they matched the prevailing wage. You'd have to do it because these people are lecturers we're talking about.
But I don't think that happens now. So, for example, someone in my department could have ADI. Thank you. How could I not remember that? You could get an ADI that puts them way above a person of higher rank. Right? But then you don't take everyone who has a lower rank and automatically give them all ADIs. That's not been my experience, at least in my department. There are people of different ranks.
You can equate what we're mandated to do by federal law, which we don't choose, with something that we choose to do on the basis of merit or equity or something else. the feds are telling us you've got to pay this person that, whether you like it or not. And
why do they tell you to pay it that?
Because that's what they determine, and they have one standard for the entire country. So it's not like they're, so somebody in Mississippi is going to get that same rate as somebody in New York State, which the pay scales are dramatically different, as you know. So, you know, for us, this is a really important issue because we just do not feel that it is fair to the university or to the other employees in that department. And part of the reason is that the, you know, the feds really, whether we like it or not, they don't want us hiring these people if there are people. I mean, we have to essentially say, in order to sponsor somebody on one of these visas, that there is nobody qualified in the entire United States to do that job, as well as this person from China, India, Zimbabwe, wherever they're from. And so, and they, I think that's, they don't like us to do that. So they want to make sure that, you know, this is, I mean, you know, we can argue about it, you know,
right.
But I think this is going to be something we're going to be, have a hard time accepting. I'll just put it that way.
Right. But whenever you're giving those increases that are mandated mm-hmm. by law, you can give them and then give notice to that person.
We can.
So that it's just a temporary, short-term
Yeah, but in
increase.
Some cases that's a year and a half. Which is a long time to keep somebody, particularly if there's somebody in a lecturer position that you're just not, you know, they're okay, but, you know, what are you saying to everybody else in the department who's coming to you and saying, well, you know, how come you're not getting, how come I'm getting not getting paid that money? Well, feds say we have to do this. Well, and we'd like to non-reappoint them, but the bargaining agreement says we've got to keep them for another year or year and a half. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's been a problem in the past because I don't think it's something that occurred with any kind of regularity. Apparently, there's been, it appears to us that it's been some kind of policy change, and there may be some larger agenda for why the department is more aggressively doing this now. I mean, it could be because they're trying to discourage the hiring under these visas, mm-hmm. you know. They want to have people, they want to make it difficult for employers to be, and not just universities, but all sorts of, from hiring under these visas, right. So that they're now aggressively going in and saying, you will have to pay some prevailing rate, not in your area or your cost of living, but we're going to set some rate in Washington, D.C. that creates an inequity on the ground here. I don't know how, I mean, one of the ways we looked at going about it was kind of creating a specialized notice status for them. Maybe we should talk about it in a different context. Maybe it's something we should talk about under wages. You know, when we have people, because technically these people are getting wage increases in a manner for a purpose that we've not negotiated.
That's already, right? Yes, we did, actually.
Well, last time we did.
Yeah.
But, I mean, before that we did.
No. Well, we added it to the exceptions from counting it as an ADI. Is what we did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's just our 2 cents on that article, so we know where the lines are, so to speak. Okay.
Well, I think just in general, if you can, for any sort of subject, unless it really hasn't come up, like the layoff one that hasn't been touched in quite a while.
Yeah.
It's really helpful, I think, to us if you have some language. Even if you say, well, this is just our first attempt, or these are rough guidelines,
sure.
Or
yeah.
Something
we can do that.
That's hard for us to, you know, we hear what your intent is, but then we don't see any language coming beside it to compare to say, okay, does this satisfy both, should this satisfy both parties or not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that would help us, I think.
We appreciate that, John.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
Did you want me to comment on 24? 24.10?
Oh, right.
I'm sorry.
Did you want me to?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
It was just a suggestion. I mean, we understand that we wrote the language so that this could be discontinued, and you know, we let people know and it makes sense in that context. We would suggest that the language remain in the contract because at the moment I don't think the state has exhausted its appeals process, and for quite a long time, the state's chief attorney made it real clear that she thought this was a really, really important issue. It's, so we sort of want to wait and make sure that some higher level court doesn't ultimately decide that the Florida constitutional language is valid, in which case, you know, we could reinstate practice pretty easily to restore the contract.
No, we're not at this point talking about, we haven't even gotten to that article yet, so we're not talking about taking it out of the contract.
Okay. This is just responding to what you were saying.
Yeah, right, you were saying you're dropping it to zero and giving notice to people that have a year.
I'm saying that that's what the contract requires us to do right now, but we're not taking the language out of the contract. We're just following the language of the contract at the moment.
No, I know we're not taking it out because...
Yeah, and we could easily reinstate it if the state, all these people that we've, the state has, I was a bit surprised, quite honestly, that the State Department of Insurance said go ahead and put these people on state insurance because there is a current appeal for the 11th Circuit, but they apparently don't think that that's going to be successful. So, people are already getting enrolled,
I cannot imagine it would be successful, but we certainly appreciate the concern. We would not want the program to go away in the absence of this change. So.
No.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
See everybody in February.